Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
What is it about a mortgage that makes people feel differently about it than any other debt? Because it's their home?
What is a mortgage? It's a simple contract. That's all it is. It's a contract.
And yet people do feel strongly about their mortgages. They'll go to heroic lengths to make sure that payment gets in on time every month, which makes it all the more surprising that so many people are giving up and walking away.
We stop making payments. We're left with very little choice in the matter. We can't, sell the house. So we're walking away. We're in the process of walking away now. Why don't you walk away?
Why don't you walk away? The housing crisis is over, but the market hasn't recovered. And when you can't sell your home and you owe more than it's worth anyway, I guess you walk away. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 8th, and The Takeaway for me is that is there something that makes it inherently more immoral for a homeowner to walk away from a mortgage than a corporation to walk away from one of their bad debts?
Well, real estate developers are walking away all the time. Why can't the little guy? That's for sure. Let's get right to the top stories this morning, and we're following a party. That's the sound of New Orleans fans celebrating their first Super Bowl win. The Saints upset the Indianapolis Colts 31-17 last night. Quarterback Drew Brees was named the game's most valuable player. He said it's a hugely meaningful win for the team, but also for the entire community in and around New Orleans.
What can I say? We played for so much more than just ourselves. We played for our city. We played for the entire Gulf Coast region. We played for all the entire Houdat Nation.
They played for the Space Shuttle Endeavour astronauts. The Endeavour blasted off this morning for the International Space Station on one of the last big construction missions for the International Space Station. Cloud cover that scrubbed Sunday's launch cleared in time for this morning's pre-dawn launch. Toyota's quality control issues are apparently doing damage to the resale market for the once highly praised cars, thanks to some unclear responses to safety questions. And with more than 90% of the votes counted in Ukraine's presidential election, the candidate who favors closer ties with Russia, the opposition, is in the lead. Iran has announced plans to speed up nuclear program plans. It's going to build 10 new enrichment plants next year. That's in the face of growing Western concern about its nuclear intentions.
Back here in the U.S., a huge blast rocked a power plant under construction in Connecticut. Latest reports say at least 5 people were killed in the blast and 12 injured. The explosion happened just before midday local time on Sunday. The authorities have ruled out terrorism. Hope Castor is a local resident.
It felt like shaking. I mean, there was a loud noise. I don't think I've ever heard a noise that was that loud. And the windows in my house actually shook.
Rescue operation continued into the night. And as we said earlier, the record numbers of homeowners are now defaulting on their mortgages. That's because nearly 11 million people owe more than their houses are worth. Marlene McGuire lives in Colorado. Marlene, you walked away from your mortgage. Why?
Because our house was worth more than what we wasn't worth as much as we owed.
So you are a former homeowner now. Are you renting?
Yes, we are.
Okay, we're going to talk more with Marlene McGuire in just a minute. Stay with us. Looking at the markets, the Dow is going to start at 10,012. The S&P begins at 1,066. And the NASDAQ will open at 2,141. So what did you take away from last night's Super Bowl?
My takeaway from the Super Bowl was the E-Trade commercials. That baby finally has new friends. He's traveling. He's even involved in a love triangle. He just gets more interesting every year.
That's our takeaway contributor, Delana Dixon, talking about her
really
takeaway.
Watches those commercials.
Yeah, we're asking
sure.
You, what was your take? Was it the Rise of the Saints or a commercial that you'll be watching all week on Hulu? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, as the values of homes continue to plummet, more and more Americans are walking away from their mortgage payments or short-selling their properties. In a minute, we'll talk to a financial expert who says that in some of these cases, it actually might be better to do what our friend Marlene McGuire did in Colorado, just walk away.
Americans are defaulting on their mortgages in record numbers. They're walking away from their homes. That's because almost 11 million people, 10.7 million, owe now more than their houses are worth. So people are voluntarily giving up their homes, even when they can, afford the payments. We get calls from listeners about this all the time.
My name is Natalie Tafoya, and I own two properties. When the market kind of took a hit, I took a hit on each property, and they're so far upside down that there's no way I'm going to ever be able to recoup those costs. They're probably over 115 grand upside down, each of the properties, so I'm walking away.
Joining us now is Roger Lowenstein. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of the upcoming book, The End of Wall Street. And with us again, Marlene McGuire. She lives in Colorado and walked away from her house when she and her husband could no longer afford their mortgage payments. Marlene, you said you walked away from your home because you were so far upside down. You actually worked with a company that's called You Walk Away, which takes consumers through the process of walking away from their mortgage. This is actually just going into foreclosure, correct?
Yes, that is true.
So what was that like, that decision for you, when you finally decided that it was time to cut your losses and walk away?
Very frustrating, because it was a house that we enjoyed being in, and after putting so much time and money into it, it's just very frustrating.
Roger Lowenstein, we hear a complaint like Marlene's all the time that the banks will not work with them to modify their loans, and you have to wonder why not. Isn't it better for the banks to modify a loan with a consumer who will pay those payments than to try and sell it for a far less than the loan was for?
Yeah, good morning. Well, I think what happens many times is the bank and the homeowner sort of play a game of chicken. And the bank may send out threatening letters saying that they're violating the mortgage contract, or in some states they can threaten to go after the homeowner's other assets, such as automobile or savings account, although they really do so. The bank obviously is hoping that the homeowner, the person like Marlene, will pay the whole thing, obviously, and the homeowner is hoping they'll get a break, and sometimes they'll voluntarily walk away. Sometimes they'll get too close to the edge, and that's why we have hundreds of thousands of foreclosures every month.
Well, listen to Steve Walsh. He's a mortgage broker in Arizona, and he's talking about one of his clients.
I have a client that bought a house for $1 million that's now appraising for $400,000. Well, they're making a $7,000 a month payment on a house they can now rent for $2,000 a month down the street. If you go back a year, we had maybe one or two people tell us they were walking away. Now it's literally every day there are a couple people walking away. It just doesn't make sense anymore, because they've lost that hope.
Roger, we hear from not only the federal government, but from the heads of the housing association saying it is not right for people to walk away from mortgages, but they're losing money.
Yeah, what we have is a sort of a social disease. When we have millions of people who own homes that are, as in this example, priced at $1 million, now only worth $400,000, people aren't going to pay mortgage payments based on a price that's 2.5 times current value, because it's obviously throwing money away. This isn't because millions of Americans suddenly became amoral or evil. We had a very bad system for pricing homes and for handing out mortgages, for which the mortgage industry was very much at fault, and the credit agencies were at fault, and Wall Street was at fault, and homeowners were at fault for taking mortgages that they couldn't afford. But the first responsibility belongs to the banker. It's the banker's responsibility to make sure that they're lending money that that will be paid back.
Well, there's a lot of people doing the math here, Roger, and in many ways the realities are so stark that walking away loses its sting. Let me ask a question to Marlene McGuire for just a moment. Marlene, now you went into foreclosure, but did you declare bankruptcy?
No, we didn't.
No. Okay, so then did the fact that you walked away from your house affect any of your other credit instruments, like your credit cards? Did it affect your credit rating? Did it make you unable to borrow for other reasons? What was the overall ripple effect?
Well, it did affect our credit rating. It did go down, and because we no longer were able to pay, we just didn't pay our payments to the home.
But it sounds like the sting wasn't that bad.
Well, it really is, because when you don't pay your house payment, and then, we were trying to keep up with a credit card, and so it really did. It was a big effect.
Thanks for clarifying that.
Roger, this is Gail Cunningham. She works for the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
Yeah.
Back in the day, people would do anything to keep a roof over their head. It was really a matter of pride. You could wave the flag of home ownership. People had mortgage burning parties. And I think that people now need to understand that having your home foreclosed on is more than losing the roof over your head. And it's going to be very difficult to certainly buy another home or even rent a place to live if you have a foreclosure on your record.
These are the kind of things that you talk about in your article for the New York Times Magazine.
Back in the day when she talks about, we can wax nostalgic about it, the banker would look you in the eye, and how's your job, how's the wife and kids, where are you living, how's the bad ankle, and assess you and say, yeah, this guy can make his payments. Back in the day, these days, no one ever sees their mortgage broker. You get a mortgage, on the internet in 30 seconds, literally in 15 minutes. So the reason that all this is happening isn't that we have a new venal class of homeowners. It's because that whole back in the day system that she's waxing nostalgic about, that the mortgage bankers themselves did away with it. You know, they were just too eager to hand out mortgages to, anybody and everybody who wanted them or didn't want them. And that's why we're having this. It's we can all get teary-eyed about the mortgage burning parties, but the mortgage industry itself did away with that one.
Okay, but will they be able to rent a place after they get foreclosed?
Of course they will. You think the mortgage industry is going to turn their back on millions of customers? It's as with the other person you were talking to, John was interviewing, how many people default on a credit card and get a new one? The banking industry has decided they would rather make zillions and zillions of loans and write off, some fraction of zillions and keep making them.
I imagine it's going to continue to get worse before it gets better. Roger Lowenstein, we have to end it there. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Marlene McGuire, former homeowner in Colorado. At 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
Early Mardi Gras in Houdat Nation. That's the sound of fans celebrating Bourbon Street in New Orleans as the city celebrates the Saints' first Super Bowl win. They beat the Indianapolis Colts 31-17. Damon Marbot runs a local restaurant in New Orleans. He says fans went wild.
Cheering, stomping, spraying beer everywhere. That was amazing. A lot of high fives. A lot of hugs.
Which isn't exactly news in New Orleans, but it's certainly joyful. Meanwhile, this morning, Space Shuttle Endeavour took off from Cape Canaveral. It's going to be the last night launch for the shuttle. It's carrying an observation deck for the International Space Station. And rescue crews in Middletown, Connecticut spent the night going through debris after an explosion at a power plant yesterday. District Deputy Fire Chief Mark Fangami says they're still trying to determine how many people were in the building when the explosion took place.
Initially, it was thought there was approximately 50 employees or contractors or workers on scene. We don't know that as a hard number right now, and we're working to confirm numbers.
So far, 12 people have been injured, 5 killed. The blast could be heard and felt 30 miles away.
Most trains, planes, and buses in D.C. are still frozen in place as the cleanup continues after the mid-Atlantic blizzard. The nation's capital is pretty well shut down again today with schools and even the government closed due to hazardous travel conditions. And President Obama says he'll convene a half-day health care session at the White House. It'll be televised late this month to try and break the political impasse on health care. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen recaps last night's Super Bowl with us.
He called it.
Hey, you want that to go?
And our first news takeout takes you directly to last night's Super Bowl. It was supposed to be a high-scoring aerial contest. It wasn't, but it was a great game of pitting two fantastic offenses. And as our sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen predicted last week, it was all about the turnovers.
Pick off. Look out. Gets past Manning, and it's Tracy Porter taking it all the way. Touchdown, New Orleans.
That may have just locked it up, that Tracy Porter interception. One interception of the game, Peyton Manning threw it, and in the end, it was all New Orleans Saints. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, you kind of called this one.
Yeah.
Recap the game for us.
It was a tough one.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Indianapolis got off to a 10-point lead. Yeah. And at that point, I would say it felt as though Indianapolis was charging ahead for their second Super Bowl. There was a fourth down stand that they had again when they stopped the Saints, and it was 10-3 at the time. Indiana held them, and at that point, the Colts had all the momentum in the game. Then we get into the second quarter and it started to shift a little bit. New Orleans started to gain a little ground. They started to get a little momentum. They scored. They built some confidence. And then the Colts punted twice. They barely got on the field. And that's when I think Peyton Manning, the quarterback for the Colts, got a little iced. He got a little cold. He got a little stiff. And there was a little worry on the Colts side because the momentum was building. Come into the second half, and that's when things really started to change, because Sean Payton, the coach for the New Orleans Saints, made a daring call the first time that an onside kick was done not in the fourth quarter.
Well, nobody was expecting this.
Onside kick to start the second half, and the ball bounces off the hands of a Colt, and it looks like the Saints had it for a second, and it's Saints football. They recover the onside kick.
Hugely risky move, and it pays off, and it really put the Colts off guard, it seemed like.
It put them off guard, and then the Saints took advantage of it. I think it would have been one thing if they had done that and then the Colts had stopped them. If the Colts had stopped them, it would have changed the character of the game. But the Saints took that opportunity and drove quickly and scored a touchdown, and that really completely shifted the entire energy of the game. And coming to the fourth quarter, that was really the most – that was a disaster. Everything crumbled for the Colts. They missed a field goal, and – of course,
it's a 51-yarder, though.
And it was Matt Stover. He hadn't hit a 50-yarder since his first year, in 1993. And then, of course, the Tracy Porter interception. Let me go back to this one. Peyton Manning was throwing his bread and butter play, and the wide receiver was cutting to the left a little bit. And he was going to curl around to the right, and he was going to throw it to the right. Well, the Tracy Porter read the play from the beginning. He knew exactly what Peyton Manning was going to throw. Peyton Manning would tell you that it was an amazing play, but really, and that some people would say he made a mistake, but really everyone was doing what they were supposed to do, but Tracy Porter knew exactly where he was going to throw it. He stopped them, and he's going to go into Saints lore for the rest of his life.
Yes, indeed. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen talking about the Super Bowl. The Saints win 31-17.
And in Connecticut, an explosion blew apart a power plant under construction in a town called Middleton. At least 5 people are dead. They're still searching for other casualties. Lucy Nalpathanchil now joins us. She's a reporter and producer at WNPR in Connecticut. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning, Celeste.
What is the latest on casualties in Middleton?
Well, here's what we know. As of last night at a briefing, there are 5 confirmed dead, up to 14 injured. When this accident first happened, there were discussions that up to 100 people could have been on site. We now know there were about 50 construction workers on site at this power plant in Middletown, Connecticut, doing some routine work when this explosion happened. So right now it's really a search and rescue situation. There are search dogs on the scene. Emergency responders from around the state have descended upon Middletown, helping to try to find more bodies, possibly survivors of these workers that were on site when that explosion happened yesterday morning.
Well, the plant was under construction. We've heard already that authorities have said it is not terrorism. Do we have any idea what the cause was?
A lot of the officials, fire officials, say that they were doing a procedure known as a blowdown, where they're purging in these pipelines of natural gas when the explosion happened. And again, this explosion was so powerful that it could be felt about 20 miles away. It pretty much ricocheted down what's known as the Connecticut Valley region, because this plant is right by the Connecticut River. So it was a very scary moment for residents in town as well as around the state, because people didn't know what was happening. And again, we're finding out that it's been contained to this site in Middletown. These construction crew on site, there might be many people buried under the metal, the rubble. Right now, they don't have a number of how many people they're looking for.
Okay, Lucy Nalpathanchil, she's a reporter and producer at WNPR.
Todd Zwillick, our Washington takeaway correspondent, joins us now with a portrait of Obama-style bipartisanship after the Democrats are licking their wounds from the results of that Massachusetts election and losing the 60-vote majority there in the Senate. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, John.
What's bipartisanship sound like? You have a little example.
Yeah, well, the president went on CBS television right before the Super Bowl. CBS carried the Super Bowl. He knew people would be watching, gave Katie Couric an interview, and invited Republicans to the table, listen to this one, to talk about health care.
How do you guys want to lower costs? How do you guys intend to reform the insurance market so people with pre-existing conditions, for example, can get health care? How do you want to make sure that the 30 million people who don't have health insurance can get it?
Of course, he's talking to the American people more than Republicans, so he can actually pick up the phone and talk to right there in Washington.
Right, he is. And what you're seeing, I think, is a continuation of a shift in strategy from the White House. Of course, we all know they lost in Massachusetts. One of the messages the Democrats say they got from that race is more transparency, bring the GOP, more cooperation in Washington. Well, what the president is doing with this is saying, well, you know, Republicans, you've been doing your traditional role of sniping from the wings, criticizing. It's been working very well. Tell you what. February 25th, come on television in this meeting. Let's hear your healthcare ideas. You know, Democrats, one advantage they do have is their healthcare ideas have always polled much more popular with the public right. than Republicans. So, hey, let's hear your ideas. Let's let the public decide. And instead
bully,
of just shooting us from the wings.
Bully
you know?
Pulpit management there from the White House. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd. Coming up, what's on the agenda for this week? Marcus Mabry from The New York Times and the BBC's Rob Watson join us as we take a look at what's ahead globally and in Washington. But first, let's check in on top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. New Orleans is celebrating after the Saints beat the Colts 31-17 in the Super Bowl last night. Damon Marbot, a restaurant manager in New Orleans, says it's a crazy, wonderful atmosphere.
The entire city is just blown up, and I think my restaurant's destroyed. It's going to take my entire staff a good 2 hours to try to put it back together. It's absolutely wonderful.
And in New Orleans, that's saying something. Parades are being prepared in the Big Easy just days before Fat Tuesday and Mardi Gras begins. Space Shuttle Endeavour rocketing towards the International Space Station at this hour. The six-person crew is carrying a new room for the station, as well as an observation deck. These are the last major pieces for the complex. There are only four more scheduled flights for the entire shuttle program.
A massive explosion at a Connecticut power plant yesterday was felt for miles around. At least five people are dead, dozens injured. Fire marshals are beginning their investigation into what caused the blast in Middletown. President Obama says New York may still be the trial venue for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind behind the September 11th attacks. But the president told CBS's Katie Couric he's still considering the objections of Mayor Bloomberg and New York's police commissioner. Senate Democrats will try to push a jobs bill through this week. This comes just days after Republican Scott Brown was sworn into Ted Kennedy's seat. One of the bill's measures would extend unemployment benefits for people whose payments have run out. And in world economic news, European markets are up. Asian markets closed a little down. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective. What's going on? What's going on?
Good morning, everyone. It may be buried by headlines about the Super Bowl and possibly Sarah Palin speaking over the weekend, but really the big thing going forward this week is the major military offensive in Afghanistan that is expected to take place any day now. The goal is to take the Taliban stronghold of Marja in the Helmand province. This will be the biggest offensive since President Obama announced his increase of 30,000 more troops to the war. Here is General Stanley McChrystal in Kabul yesterday.
All the planning for this operation has been led by the civilian side, with the military in support. And, of course, this is an Afghan-led operation. That's the thing that has been so impressive thus far.
Well, what will we be thinking about the operation by the end of the week? Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times, joins us in the studio. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Rob Watson, political correspondent for our partner, the BBC, joins us from London. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. You'll have to excuse me if I'm a bit slow because I stayed up to watch some other Super Bowl, and as you can imagine, with the time difference.
So did we all. And it's one of the few times that we actually are sympathetic about the time difference for
coffee
you, Rob.
Provided
today. That's right, exactly. So let's talk about what's at stake here in Afghanistan. It's Afghan led. Stanley McChrystal is actually announcing it in advance with the idea of kind of intimidating the Taliban. In terms of on the ground, do they need to take Marjan in the next couple of days for this to be effective?
I'm not sure that they need to take it in the next couple of days, but in many ways this is all about momentum and all about the new way of fighting in Afghanistan, the new way of trying to win this conflict. So it certainly has to be a success, and obviously to some extent the ground has been prepared, both here in the US, in the UK, where about 5,000 British troops will be involved, and in the US for the idea that there could be heavy casualties.
And Marcus Mabry, what do you think is at stake? And the president hasn't mentioned much about Afghanistan and this surge, and I'm wondering if that's deliberate.
Well, everything's at stake at this point. You know, the American public support for the war effort is waning greatly. One of the few, and so we have to show market progress on the ground. Stan McChrystal has talked about some of that happening already. We have to do more if we're going to keep public support going. One of the merciful kind of things that the president's been spared with the victory of Scott Brown up in Massachusetts, right, taking his old seat, the kind of obsession right now with whether or not the Democrats can survive, can get their health care reform going, keep it on life support, our jobs, comes from the fact that now they're, Afghanistan's off the boiler for the president.
And what they're trying to get on the boiler or on the agenda this week, certainly congressional Democrats want a vote on a jobs bill today. Here's Harry Reid.
96% of the jobs created in the last 10 years have been by small businesses. So we're going to have to focus on letting more entrepreneurs do their thing.
Can the Democrats co-opt this entrepreneurs give money to small business message that's been so popular with Republicans and regain the high ground on jobs this week?
Well, it's kind of amazing. Democrats have to turn to jobs, of course. But it's kind of amazing that the Democrats are actually talking about things like small business right now and small business tax credits. Those are, you know, phrases you have not heard often put together in Democratic mouths. But the fact that Democrats have co-opted that central ground, that kind of moderate Republican ground, really, I think, shows how serious they are about, number one, getting something that politically is viable in Washington. It's going to be hard for the Republicans to say, sit back with their hands folded on this, something that has both the phrase small business tax credits and the phrase jobs in it and not do anything.
But does it get Republican votes? That's the huge question.
That's exactly the question. It's hard to imagine, again, that some Republicans won't come on board. You know, in the Senate, again, the Republicans can stop every single legislative measure from happening if they want by threatening the filibuster. They could do that. It'll be pretty unconscionable that they would do that in this regard. And if they do, then they're really overplaying their political hands, and the Democrats have an opening there to say, look, we're trying to do help small businesses. We're trying to do, give tax credits to small businesses. We're not looking to spend big government money. We're trying to help entrepreneurs.
At the risk of creating an international incident, Rob Watson?
Yes.
Do you know what an onside kick is? Can you explain that to me?
Well,
you watched the Super Bowl last night, correct?
Yes, I did.
And?
And I've just been rewatching the highlights, I have to confess. An onside kick is when you take a short kick rather than punting it all the way down in the hope of turning over possession.
He did very well.
It's pronounced, John. It's the same thing in rugby, so maybe that's how it is.
Oh, nice, nice. All right, so how big of a deal is the Super Bowl in the UK, Rob Watson, aside from your own personal proclivities?
Well, to get into it, to make it a bit personal to start with, my neighbour in Oxford is from New Orleans, and so it's been very big. He's been telling me about it all, so I was kind of watching out of sympathy with him, so no doubt he's got a bit of a sore head this morning. But the BBC has taken over coverage of it here in the UK, so I guess I've got to wave the rattle for that. I think it is pretty big. You know, I'm sure a lot of people will have stayed up, and for most of the time we took the main US coverage, but we had a little pre-show of our own, and you know, I do think that if British people stay up in time to see that part of America, you just can't help but love it. I mean, the bit where the jets fly over just after the national anthem, as a long-time resident of the U.S., I just go weak at the knees for that stuff.
I love that. That's fantastic. And you know, I guess it also says that New Orleans really is an international city with an international sort of identity. Let's end the agenda with Sarah Palin speaking at the Tea Party convention in Nashville. Listen.
The Obama Pelosi Reid agenda. It's going to leave us less secure, more in debt, and more under the thumb of big government. And that is out of touch, and it's out of date. And if Scott Brown is any indication, it's running out of time.
All right, so the former vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, is back. Did she and the National Tea Party convention in Nashville move the needle at all, and are they likely to move the needle this week?
They haven't moved the needle yet, but what's clear is if we look at the amount of media attention that they got, this really relatively small gathering, it shows a kind of, you know, political mojo that's on their side. Certainly the media attention will continue to be focused on them.
And of course there was the inevitable question on Fox News. Here's Chris Wallace and Sarah Palin.
Why wouldn't you run for president?
I would. I would if I believe that that is the right thing to do for our country and for the Palin family. Certainly, I would do so.
Which is a harder question to answer. What's right for the country or what's right for the Palin family?
Well, you know, I think what's right for the Republican Party is the hard thing to answer.
Good answer. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times, and an expat Super Bowl fan, Rob Watson, over there in London. Thanks, Rob. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Election officials in Ukraine say they've now counted 93% of the votes cast in Sunday's presidential election. And opposition leader Viktor Yanukovych is still in the lead, but his margin is now less than 2.5%. His opponent, Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, is refusing to admit defeat and has appealed to her election team around the country to fight for every vote. Joining us with details is Alexei Solohubenko. She's head of the Europe region at the BBC World Service. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
So Yanukovych is still in the lead, and are people projecting that he is going to take the win?
I think probably yes. I think there were all sorts of things from Yulia Tymoshenko, all sorts of announcements and calls from Yulia Tymoshenko's headquarters. But it appears that the margin is sufficient enough to call it a valid election. And also various observers from the U.S., from the European Union, from Russia are saying that basically the polling went well and democratically. And therefore, I think it will be very difficult for her to challenge it, either through courts or through mass rallies.
Meaning that the result was reflected in the exit polls, which also showed Yanukovych walking away with the win. But could Tymoshenko stage a successful contesting of the election results?
I don't think at this stage this is possible, frankly. She would like to, but I think the overwhelming body of evidence coming from the electoral districts from across Ukraine is that actually the results are overwhelmingly in favor of Yanukovych. The margin, as you said, is very, very small, and the hope was on her side that if it is as small as it is, she would be able to reverse it. We're talking about 500,000, maybe 600,000 votes as the margin, but I think it will be very difficult for her to do it because of the overwhelming acceptance of the elections as democratic by various observers at this stage.
Well, Tymoshenko was a large figure in the protests known as the Orange Revolution about 5 years ago that put Ukraine onto a pro-Western slant. Is Yanukovych going to be moving the country in the other direction?
I think in some areas, yes. He already said that he will renegotiate the extension of the Russian Black Sea fleet stationing in Crimea, in Sevastopol. He also said he will look into the status of the Russian language in Ukraine and reverse some of the previous politics. I think he is very cold about NATO, and I don't think that either of the people engaged in this final round of presidential race were very, very keen on joining NATO. However, he wants to be part of the European Union. He understands that European Union is now the greatest trading partner with Ukraine. And therefore, yes, he will be friendly with Russia, more friendly than the previous president was. But I don't think he'll be a puppet. He won't be in cahoots with the Russian business, with Russian politicians. He'll be defending the interests of Ukraine, perhaps less vocally than the previous authorities.
So we'll have to kind of see. He has said that he wants closer relations with Russia, but we'll have to kind of see how that plays out and in what exactly that means. Alexei Solohubenko is the head of the Europe region at the BBC World Service. He joined us from Bush House. He's talking about the election results in Ukraine. At this point, 93% of the votes have been counted, and it looks like the opposition leader, Viktor Yanukovych, is in the lead and will probably walk away with the presidential win.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. We're going to talk about international adoption, the perils and joys of international adoptions. They're actually declining around the world, but there doesn't mean they're any less complicated. First of all, we're going to check leading stories at 40, coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. The Super Bowl win, the Saints 31-17 over the Indianapolis Colts, has New Orleans in party mood, as if that's difficult to do. Bartender Cole Hernandez says she's been waiting for this for many years.
I waited my whole life for this, and I tell you what, the Saints deserve it more than Peyton Manning could ever wish for.
This is a victory for New Orleans. This is a victory for the Gulf Coast region, everybody who lost their homes in Katrina. The Saints have jailed all of us together.
parades are expected over the next few days leading into Mardi Gras. Fire officials in Middletown, Connecticut say no one is known to be missing now in the rubble of an unfinished power plant that was damaged by a huge explosion yesterday. The explosion at the Clean Energy Systems plant in Middletown, about 20 miles south of Hartford, killed at least five workers and injured a dozen or more on Sunday. Fire officials say multiple contractors were working on the project, making it difficult to quickly account for everyone.
Meanwhile, this morning, Space Shuttle Endeavour took off from Cape Canaveral. It's going to be the last nighttime launch for the shuttle program. The six astronauts on board are hauling an observation deck for the International Space Station. The shuttle is set to arrive at the station early on Wednesday. The nation's capital is pretty well shut down still after a weekend blizzard buried the city and the suburbs in more than 2 feet of snow. Federal agencies are closed and many school districts as well are giving students a snow day. And they're digging out in Southern California as well, only it's mud that's sent everyone digging. Evacuated residents have been allowed back into the mud-caked area north of Los Angeles. 43 homes were damaged by mudslides triggered by rain on Saturday. And President Obama said Sunday he will convene a half-day health care session at the White House to be televised live this month to try and break the political impasse on health care. The Super Bowl, big spectacle, big entertainment, big business as well. Television advertisements during this year's Super Bowl reach some 100 million Americans, but it's also a global phenomenon as well. Foreign businesses use the broadcast to advertise and strengthen their branding. We're joined now by BBC's David Kuhn from London to talk about it. So how big of a deal is the Super Bowl outside the United States, David?
Hello. Well, it's getting bigger and bigger, I would say, and its popularity continues to grow outside the US. And we are talking about very different markets such as Mexico, the UK, Australia, Japan. Many, many countries are now watching the Super Bowl and now following the NFL games. This year, for example, in London in October, we'll have another NFL game, the 49ers against the Denver Broncos in October, and that would be the 11th NFL game that is played in London and the third one of a regular season game. So you can imagine that it's getting bigger and bigger.
Do we have any evidence that the advertising during the Super Bowl actually works in other countries?
Well, you know, for example, I can tell you about the example of Mexico. In Mexico, what happens is that the advertisements that you see in the U.S. is not the same that it's broadcast in Mexico. But what you see there is that local advertisers, probably a global brand with a local touch, will use the Super Bowl to launch their own advertisement, but with the NFL logo. So it's, again, the same show business of advertisement, but with a local flavor and always using the NFL brand. So everybody feels that like they're watching the live ads on the Super Bowl.
Okay, David Kuhn from the BBC talking about advertisements during the Super Bowl. Thanks so much. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Roll out of the shadows and find that eventually. There we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
This morning's family segment is motivated by the issues raised by the arrest of those 10 American Baptist Church members and the 33 children they tried to take out of the earthquake-devastated nation of Haiti. In the world of international adoptions, the issues vary from nation to nation. Diplomats may be involved as much as social workers. Relations between the country of origin and the adoptive home may be as important as the family-to-family issues. And as parents learn, there is also a wide variance in the degree of candor about the circumstances of the adoptive children from country to country. David Smolin and his wife learned some of these lessons firsthand. David is a professor of law and a self-described inter-country adoption reformer. Good morning from Alabama, David.
Yes, morning.
Well, first of all, what are the unique perils and difficulties associated with country-to-country adoptions that you wouldn't find in a purely domestic adoption?
Well, I'd say it's that most inter-country adoption agencies in the U.S. don't really know that much about what goes on in the other country and don't take responsibility legally, ethically, for how the child is obtained and whether the child is a true orphan. There's a tendency to outsource all of the important work to a foreign orphanage or foreign just someone who comes to them or that they recruit and they pay to find children.
Right. Now, you know, many people in America who know anything at all about international adoptions may get their impression from listening to celebrities talk about their experience. Here's Brad Pitt.
You know, I look at my sons and my daughters, and one's from Vietnam, and one's from Cambodia, and one's from Ethiopia, and there's this kid who was born in Namibia. Each one of them offers so much to the mix.
We can only hope that Brad knows the actual names of the children in his own home. But, I mean, this celebrity idea that you can sort of pick and make a kind of, United Nations General Assembly around your breakfast table is really a misnomer and has nothing to do with what parents like yourselves went through.
Well, the problem is that there aren't as many orphans as people think there are. There are a lot of poor families who are willing to place children into some kind of place so they can get an education and that they can get room and board. But a lot of times those families do not intend to actually give up their children. But somewhere in this mix, children who are not true orphans end up getting placed into families here. And that's quite a tragedy.
What happened to you in 1998 when you adopted two girls from India? And congratulations for that, by the way.
Well, what happened is that we went through a very well-accredited, very reputable agency here, and yet despite that, and despite trying to adopt older children for whom there's more of a need, we ended up tragically taking children away from a family who had a family. Their mom had been tricked into placing them somewhere just for room and board and for an education, when in fact the Indian orphanage intended to profit from placing them overseas.
Wow. So David Smolin, this idea of trafficking, which was raised by the Haitian church members, or the American church members who are trying to get kids out of Haiti, is actually something that people might encounter without knowing it.
Exactly. We've had trafficking scandals in China now, Guatemala, Nepal, India, Cambodia, Vietnam, Samoa. So it's become quite a common thing. And also we've had it in the past in Haiti as well.
So David, what did you do when you discovered that there was a family back in India of your two daughters?
Well, we had to do it on our own, because even though we used a very reputable agency, they wouldn't help us figure it out. So we had older children, and they were coached to lie to us, tragically.
Oh.
And when the story emerged through their own friend who'd been adopted into a different family here, they were pretty sure something was wrong, but they really didn't know, tragically, whether their mother had sold them or been tricked. And that just absolutely tortured them. The agency took the position that they did not need to know and that we did not need to know. So it took about 6 years to find somebody in India willing to go and try to find the rural village where our daughters said they were from. This had to be done gently, because we were told that if she had given them up voluntarily, the mom that is, that she could be harmed if someone went looking for her. So we had to find an appropriate person to do it, and because our agency, which is now a Hague-accredited agency, would not help us, we had to find our own way, which took a long time.
Well, and your daughters are in contact now with their birth parents, and through your own efforts, not certainly the institutions, you created a happy ending out of this, which should also be a cautionary tale for anyone else trying to do country-to-country adoptions. David Smolin, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you, too.
David Smolin is a law professor and an intercountry adoption reformer who has two daughters adopted from India who, it turned out, were part of a trafficking effort that he attempted to rectify on his own.
So we're asking you today, what did you take away from last night's Super Bowl?
This is Patrick Henry Bass, and my takeaway from the Super Bowl was a great game, lame commercials with the exception of Hockenberry's very favorite comedian, Jay Leno, with Oprah and David Letterman.
That was friend of the show, Patrick Henry Bass. What was your take? Was it the rise of the Saints, or was it the commercials themselves? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.